So we're in John 17. We're going to go verses 17 through 19. So we're in the chapter 17 and we see Jesus. He's praying for the church. And among the things he prays for in his final wishes, as Jesus is basically preparing for his own death, we see Jesus pray for holiness. Now, to spend time with someone or spoken to someone who is nearing death, you see in their what they talk about is clarity, someone and purpose. And during this moment in this prayer, we see something as a final wish by Jesus. Jesus prays for the church and he prays for our holiness. Now, if you were going to a bookstore and you were going to the spirituality section of a bookstore, you probably would find books on joy. You find books on hope. You find books on prayer, on maybe accessing the divine, but you probably won't find many books on holiness. Holiness, in fact, is not the most popular topic when it comes to spirituality. And the reason is typically when we think of holiness, I think the words miserable might come up, ascetic, self-denial, self-renunciation. And what that suggests is we simply don't understand holiness in the way Jesus Christ understands holiness. And if we are to understand who Jesus Christ really is, and if we are to have a relationship with him, we have to understand his definition of holiness and why, in fact, he desires it for us, for the church. So this morning, we're going to consider three things. We're going to look at the definition of holiness, the overflowing impact of holiness, and the joyful power of holiness. Definition, impact, and joyful power. So first, in these verses, we see the definition of holiness. And Jesus uses the word sanctify. And the word sanctify means to make holy. The word make holy means to be set apart. So for instance, something that is designated for a specific purpose or set aside for a particular function. You and I, as we're going to see, we are set apart because of the beauty of character, because of a moral attractiveness. There is a wholeness. There is an integrity and completeness we'll see. And it's in this particular meaning, the notion of moral beauty, this is what Jesus is probably referring to in this particular passage, and it comes to truth. To sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. What Jesus is saying is this. There is a moral beauty you can grow in. There is a virtuous attractiveness that I want people to grow in that makes them distinctive and set apart, Jesus is saying. And it's a beauty that is defined by a particular standard. Truth. Your word is truth. And the word holiness actually comes from an older English word, which means whole or health. And it has the idea that holiness is critical for wholeness. And it was critical for any kind of human thriving, any kind of human flourishing. Now, I don't know everyone in here. I don't know if some of you are in here. Maybe you are considering Christianity. You're here to see who is Jesus. Who are you guys talking about? And maybe you think Christians, when they talk about holiness, they're killjoys. Christians are concerned about following particular rules of conduct. But I'm here to say the truth of the matter is, in every culture, every human society, every generation has a set of conduct. Certain things that they are to abide by to make flourishing possible. It's always some kind of principle or always some kind of standard that we seem to align with. And if we do so, we feel fulfilled. In our modern world today, our most prevalent ethics, our most prevalent modern values is really the value of authenticity. It is seen as being critical for human fulfillment, for flourishing. Be yourself. A few years ago, I found an article in the New York Times. And the article was titled, "Unless You're Oprah, Be Yourself is Terrible Advice." And in this particular piece, is essentially about how the modern world, the ethos that we live by, the ethics that we are encouraged to live by, is we are to express ourselves. We are to live in accordance with this particular rule or a particular code of conduct to be authentic and to constantly express who you are. And this is why this piece, this article, the beginning of it says, "We are in an age of authenticity, where be yourself is a defining advice in life, love, and career. Authenticity means erasing the gap between what you firmly believe inside and what you reveal to the outside world. We want to live authentic lives. We want to marry authentic partners. We want to work for an authentic boss." But this piece goes on to describe kind of the downside of being of this particular authenticity. Namely, not everyone wants to know everything that's inside of you. Not everyone wants to know what's going on inside. Because we all have attitudes, we have thoughts, we have convictions that are very fundamental to who we are. But sharing this with others oftentimes has significant social consequences. We pay a personal price. We can pay a professional price if we are sharing every single thing we think or every single thing we believe. Being yourself, being authentic, is there's a warning. So this piece, this article closes and it says, "If not our authentic selves, what should we be striving to reach? Sincerity, which is integrity or wholeness. Instead of searching for our inner selves and then making a concerted effort to express them, pay attention to how we present ourselves to others and then strive to be the people we claim to be." Here's the point. We all live according to some kind of external standard or some kind of ethical set of values. That is not unique to Christianity. It's something we all do. It's something that every culture has always done. And so the question isn't whether we have a standard which we abide by, a standard which we live by. But which standard does that happen to be? Whether it's the truth of the Bible, or is that standard an ethic of authenticity in which you will feel like you are flourishing? And what Jesus uses in this set, a particular model, the picture for human thriving, he says, is holiness, a life of moral beauty, character that is being shaped by the truth. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is true. Now, we also see in these verses the impact or the overflow of a life of holiness. But what Jesus talks about when he begins to speak is, in fact, that holiness, that there's this notion of being sent. There's this sense of mission. And that's why he says, "As you send me into the world, I've sent them into the world." There's an outward impact, a mission, a trajectory to holiness. And one of the ways that people think about holiness, one of the ways we often think about holiness, is really like self-denial. It's merely by abiding by a list of things to do or not to do, a bunch of prohibitions and rules we're to live by. In a way, that is true. It's not less than self-denial. It's not less than honoring the prohibitions. But let me say it this, it is much, much more than merely ordering a set of prohibitions. Holiness is much more than a life of self-denial. Craig Bloomberg, he's a Christian writer, a Christian thinker, and he notes that if you look at the ministry of Jesus Christ and you consider his miracles, the way we described about the people who Jesus is associated with, that he shared with, you see this directional flow of holiness. For instance, throughout the Old Testament, impurity was to be avoided because it was believed that you can be contaminated. Your holiness was somehow compromised depending upon what you touched, what you ate, who you happened to be connected with, what you did, where you went. And that's why, for instance, many of the religious leaders at that time, they were so troubled by the company that Jesus kept, that he ate with tax collectors, that he ate with sinners, that he touched lepers. He spent time with morally questionable people. And the concern was that somehow holiness, that purity, it could be lost, which would undermine him as a religious leader. In other words, the prevailing notion was uncleanliness. It was contagious. But what you see in Jesus, and what you see in the people who he associated with, and what you see in the people that he touched and spent time with, the exact opposite is true. In Jesus, there is something that is contagious. But now, what is contagious goes the other way. It's not impurity that is contagious. It's his holiness. It's his purity that is contagious. In the Old Testament, if you touched a leper, you were considered unclean. But Jesus touches a leper, and that touch makes the leper clean. And when Jesus touched the leper, Jesus came in contact with something that was unclean. But when the leper touched Jesus, the leper perhaps for the very first time in his life touched something that was clean, and he was healed. So there's a story in the Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, about a woman who had a bleeding disorder for 12 years. According to Old Testament regulation, that if you're a woman with a bleeding disorder and it lasted more than 7 days, you were considered unclean. That meant social exclusion, it meant religious isolation, and here is a woman with a bleeding disorder for 12 years being unclean. 12 years of isolation, 12 years of exclusion. And the woman comes up to Jesus, and he touches his cloak. And because of her faith that Jesus could heal her, she is healed. It's Jesus' proximity and a mere touch of his cloak that makes her clean. Right after this particular story, there's a story about Jesus raising a dead girl to life. And in that particular story, Jesus is with the dead girl and he speaks to her. He took her by the hand, and she comes to life. At that time, death was considered the ultimate expression of uncleanness. There was nothing more broken, nothing more defiled, nothing more unclean than death. If you touched a corpse, you were unclean. If you stepped over a corpse, you were considered unclean. And yet Jesus touches this girl's hand. His contact doesn't make him unclean. His contact remakes her. His contact revives her and brings her back to life, and it makes her clean. We see holiness is not merely about what someone avoids or what someone doesn't touch. It's about a contagious moral beauty, a wholeness of character that brings life to everything that isn't in touch with. Look, I understand the Bible has very specific prohibitions about what not to do with our thought life, about what not to do with our money, about what not to do with our bodies. But if you have a growing relationship with God, with the God of the Bible, you take those things seriously. Not taking those things seriously is like having a relationship that is absolutely dead. But holiness isn't just about protecting against impurity. It's also about cleanness. It's about integrity. It's about moral beauty. It's about reshaping this world. There is a mission. There is an impact on holiness. So if you think of the Ten Commandments, if you read the Ten Commandments, each one of them is phrased as a prohibition, something you shall not do. And yet, each one of them is a very powerful and meaningful affirmation. So in other words, they're not just what to avoid, but we see what to affirmatively value, what we are to promote, what we are to practice. For example, do not murder. Do not murder is a prohibition, but it's a reminder that holiness means affirming life. And it means to work against exploitation. It means working against injustice, oppression, or anything that would diminish life in a person. It means treating people with dignity, even though we completely disagree with them. Or, for instance, do not covet. Do not covet is, on one hand, a prohibition against envy. But on the other hand, it's a reminder to to live with profound gratitude, to not squander what we have, to be thankful, to not grumble or to complain. Do not commit adultery means a commitment to relational wholeness and integrity. Do not bear false witness means a commitment to integrity and truthfulness in our words and in our behavior. And holiness is not simply preserving purity by avoiding impurity, but holiness is about imparting integrity and affirmation in human dignity, relational health that can fix this broken world. It means going into broken parts of life, broken areas of life that are unclean, and making those things whole and bringing restoration. It means helping others who experience relational heartache so that they can experience relational wholeness. It means helping neighbors in need who experience oppression or injustice. It means working with integrity and with truthfulness in our workplace. And it means being vulnerable to serve and to heal the broken and unclean parts of this world, and to help bring health and wellness into this world. So where does this holiness come from? Where does this power of holiness? Well, we see in these verses something of a joyful power that gives us holiness. But in reality, is that whatever behaviors we practice, whatever way we behave differently, whatever things we decide to avoid, we know that that cannot bring true holiness. There is an unclean thing that goes much deeper than practice, that goes much deeper than our behavior. It goes much deeper than do's and don'ts. It goes much deeper than to touch or not to touch. And Jesus, that's why Jesus said in his words in Matthew 15, what goes into someone's mouth does not defile them, but what comes out of their mouth, that is what defiles them. There's sin in the human heart. That is what makes us unclean. There is a wholeness, a cleanness that can't come by changing our behavior or adjusting our moral practice. It has to go deeper. It has to be a cleanness of heart. And what that New York Times article was talking about not being yourself is probably the best advice. Being authentic is the best advice. What the author is acknowledging is that the issue is not what we express on the outside, but acknowledging there's something broken on the inside. There is an uncleanness that we can't easily get rid of, which means there never will be true wholeness, which is a change of behavior. What we need is more than authenticity. There needs to be a consistency between the inside and the outside. And that's why this verse says we need joy. Jesus has been preaching about joy. This entire chapter, he talks about it. Jesus prays for joy. He prays for the church. This theme has been consistent throughout these verses, this overflow series. John 15, Jesus says, I've told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. John 16, I ask and you will receive and your joy will be complete. John 17, I am coming to you now, but I say these things while I am still in the world so that they may have the full measure of my joy within them. Then John 17, Jesus prays for the church. He prays for unity, for protection. He prays also for holiness and joy. Here's why holiness and joy though must come together. A life of moral principle and conduct without joy, it's cold, it's lifeless, it's heartless, it's duty bound. At the same time though, a life of joy without a meaningful change behavior, that's just being merely cheery or merely being happy. Put it this way, following rules of conduct, trying to be good without joy, that's just moralism. And it causes into question, is it true holiness if it only resides on the outside? Do you know where the truest form of joy? Do you know where we see the truest form of joy filled holiness and moral beauty? It's right here in John 17, verse 19. For them, I sanctify myself, that they too may be sanctified. And what it means that Jesus sanctified himself is not that Jesus was lacking some moral character. He decided he needed to get more of it. It's not saying Jesus had a moral deficiency that he had to fill. What it means that Jesus sanctified himself was that he set himself apart. He set himself on a course singularly focused on one thing. One thing that captured his heart, that directed, that oriented all of his conduct, all of his behavior, became singularly focused in his heart, and it brought him joy. What was that? Hebrews 12 says, Jesus Christ, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame. He did it for joy. It was a joy that he set himself apart. It was a joy that he constrains himself. What's the joy that was set before him? Well, it's the joy of having you, of having me. It's the joy of setting you apart, that you may be truly sanctified, that you may be set apart with his love. And what you see on the cross of Jesus Christ, instead of shunning all impure things, is in his own cleanness and out of his joy, he touched the most unclean thing. In fact, on the cross, Jesus Christ ultimately experienced death itself. And in doing so, he made you, he made me clean. He sanctified us. He set us apart for his love. What does it mean that he sanctified himself so that they too may be truly sanctified? It's this. Jesus Christ's joy was found in you so that your joy can be found in him. And he became unclean so you would no longer be treated as unclean. And he set himself apart with the joy for you, even though it cost him his life, so that you could be set apart with joy for him. To make this a little clearer, you know, I just happened to go to the pet store the other day. Caleb had won a fish at the fair, so I had to go buy some fish stuff. And we were at the pet store for a long time. But I saw this picture on the wall. It was a black and white photo. I wish I took a picture of it. But it was a black and white picture. And it was just of a dog. It was jumping. It was probably jumping up and down next to his master. But his leash was on. But this dog was happy. And it's very counterintuitive for the modern person to look at that picture and wonder why the dog is happy. Here's the dog. He's on a leash. He's constrained. He's confined. It seems cruelly restrictive for him to be bound to his master. But apparently the dog doesn't see it this way. And in this photo, the dog is jumping up and down, frankly, as happy as you can imagine. But he's not jumping away from his master. He's not trying to pull away from his master. But he's just jumping up and down. The dog is, in fact, happy. He's content. Actually feels totally free, even though he's particularly confined, he's constrained to that leash. And again, in this age of authenticity, this notion that anything that constrains us, anything that we commit to, anything that binds us, it will cause us to shudder. So, but why is this dog happy? Do you know why this dog feels so free? Because the dog, even though it is constrained and bound to its master, at the other end of the leash, there is a master that is bound and constrained to the dog. In other words, not only is a dog bound to the master, but the master has bound himself to the dog and has committed and constrained and dedicated himself to the dog so that they could belong to one another. You know, the reason we think some holiness is some kind of oppressive constraint is that we simply don't understand the flourishing and the freedom that holiness can bring. Jesus Christ, constrained himself. It says he sanctified himself so that we could be sanctified. And he was constrained out of his joyful love for you, so that we could be constrained out of joyful love for him. And while we are called to be bound to him, it's only because he was bound to us first, for us. And for the sake of the joy of having you, he sanctified himself and he endured the cross for you, so that you, so that I can live a life of holiness for the sake of the joy of having him. And that's why we sing this song, this hymn from time to time. And also it could be a prayer for us. And the hymn goes like this. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it for thy courts above. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, I thank you for this time of worship through your word. Lord, it's amazing that holiness is not constraints. It's not a list of to do or not to do. But Lord, it is moral beauty found within us because Jesus sanctified.